My main area of interest is volcanoes, particularly the ways in which volcanoes can collapse, fail, slide, and otherwise self-destruct in hazardous ways. And hazard assessment around volcanoes, particularly in the Cascades, is one of the main things I work on. This week, I wanted to kind of put together a program that set the geology of the Holden environment kind of in perspective. And I'll start today by really giving you some background kind of stuff, both setting the Cascade Range and both in time, in geologic time, and in space, and the general mechanisms by which it is understood that the mountain range has evolved. Tomorrow we'll talk a little bit about rocks. I think tomorrow we'll be back in the other room, in the fireside room. And I'll explain a little bit about the basic types of rocks that make up the mountains, and then we'll zip out for a real short nature hike a little ways up the trail toward Ten Mile Creek Falls and look at some outcrops of these rocks in place. I have a break on Wednesday. Thursday, we switch over to the water side of the equation, and I'll talk a little bit about hydrology in the mountains, the water cycle, and how that works here in this particular montane environment. We'll connect that with the rocks on Friday, and I have a little thing called How Rocks Rot. First couple days, we're going to build rocks, and end of the week, we'll tear them down again. And that's, you can look at geology as a big cycle, too, of rocks coming together, being formed, and then breaking down. Their components being redistributed and making other kinds of rocks and minerals, and the whole thing cycling through. And then Saturday, I'll talk about glaciers, and we'll be back mostly just talking at the whiteboard again. And then my format, I'm going to have to talk fast, I think, today, but we'll try to keep it to about 45 minutes. I welcome questions, so please jump in if something doesn't make sense. I'm going to have a lot of names and details that I'll kind of throw out. They aren't essential, but the whole picture kind of hangs together in the details in a way, because you need them to explain what's happening, both in time and space. And geology, like lots of areas, has its own jargon, and it's hard to talk about it without using a little of that, so I'll try to minimize it. And if you don't understand some term, please scream out. Okay, I guess we're ready to start the tape. So what I'd like to do this morning is to set the picture for the Cascades, both in time and space. And I'd like to start with a discussion of geologic time. After that, I want to move on to the general background of an incredible revolution, really, in geologic sciences that occurred only about 20 years ago, which has totally revamped the way scientists think about the Earth and its history. And then we'll end the third part with how that new paradigm, how that new concept of how it all fits together actually explains what we're sitting amongst here in the North Cascades. Okay, so I'll start with time. And I'll do a little exercise with you just to begin. And that is to try to convert geologic time, the immense vastness of geologic time, to something that's a little more concrete, that we can visualize. And I'll do that by a physical timeline that I hope will help. And really, the whole mystery of geologic time was what fascinated me about geology in the first place. I just had a lot of trouble wrapping my brain around these immense amounts of time. But let's assume that all of recorded human history, about 5,000 years, is represented by 1 inch on a timeline. And let's start it right here, and we'll run it down the road that way. If we go back to the beginning of the time when humans were starting to run around on Earth, and I'm going back to some of the earlier forms of hominids that have been, Leakey and his associates have been digging out of Africa. That goes back about 4 million years. That would take us about 67 feet back on our timeline. we're still hardly begun on the journey. If we then go back to when the dinosaurs were extinct, that was about 63 million years ago. One of the major terminal events in Earth history, a tremendous time of extinction on Earth. And the theories that are raging right now about what caused that's another whole topic, but we won't, I don't think, have time to get into. But at that time, when Tyrannosaurus Rex was walking around, would be, oh, there's one right there.
Hannah corrected me, and she said 65 million. I'm sure there's a discrepancy there.
That's within the slot.
Could be either way.
To get to that time, you have to go back about 1,000 feet down the road. A few football field lengths down the road, which is really not too far. The Earth is still much older than that. If we go back to the time when animals and plants first started appearing on the land surface, about 450 million years ago, we'd have to go 1.4 miles down the road. And if we go all the way back to the beginning of the Earth as we understand it now, as radiometric dating indicates, the Earth began about 4.7 billion years ago. That would take us almost 15 miles down the road. So we'd have to go all the way down to Lucerne and across the lake and partway up the other side. So we're dealing with a tremendous amount of time, and I've got it here on a crude timeline. And we break, and here's some of the terminology which may or may not be useful to you. And this is not to scale, because this Precambrian period, which is the time before life really got going on Earth, there were, toward the end of that period, there were some bacteria and some algae and some fairly primitive life forms, we think. We have fossils for some of those. But four-fifths of the Earth's history is in that first time period. And all the rest, the last fifth is in here. And it's the early geologists, way back when geology became a science, broke it down into these eras, of the Paleozoic, early life, Mesozoic, middle life, and Cenozoic, late life. And then these are all the epochs which are within those time periods. Again, we're out of scale because Paleozoic time is much longer than either of these other two. And the Cenozoic is the shortest of all. This is only the time since the end of the Cretaceous, when the dinosaurs died out, about 63 to 65 million years here. Jurassic Park, maybe you've seen that. See, Jurassic was one of the time epochs within the Mesozoic time. And really, the dinosaurs came about during this whole Mesozoic period. They evolved during the Triassic and late Jurassic and Cretaceous was really their heyday. Cenozoic, we sometimes refer to as the time of mammals. That's when the mammals really got established, got a good foothold on Earth. And the Paleozoic begins with the explosion of life, which occurred at the beginning of the Cambrian period. A real interesting story there that's being interpreted, reinterpreted right now too by geologists. About 600 million years ago, and we went from those early multicellular animals, the beginnings of crabs and shrimps and those kinds of arthropods. Fishes developed in here too. And then another big extinction event at Permian time, somewhat similar to the one that ended the Cretaceous. So I might refer to these as we go along. And the North Cascades really have been evolving over quite a period of time from the end of the Mesozoic, but primarily into the early Cenozoic time. So in terms of the history of the Earth, the North Cascades are not all that old. Generally in the range from maybe 70 million up to 20 or 30 million years ago was the time when they were really quite dynamic. And yet things are still, as you know now, we have volcanoes that are active in the Cascades, so really we can't say that the Cascades are a dead mountain range because they still are evolving. Let me now then talk a little bit about how geologists have been thinking about the Earth and its history. There have been lots of concepts down through the ages, from the early Greeks and so on, and even before, as to what the Earth was, how do you represent it. I think it was the early Aztecs culture in Mexico believed that it was the back of a giant turtle, was the Earth, and it was going through space. As you know, early Europeans visualized a very flat Earth with edges that you could literally fall off. And that was one of the things that kept exploration somewhat limited until some fairly intrepid guys got out there in their boats and proved that you wouldn't fall off. Geology as a science really got going in the early 19th century, primarily in England and in Europe. And those early geologists noticed a number of things about what they saw in the rocks and on the Earth itself. One was that it was obvious that a lot of rocks had been molten in the past, a type of rock we call igneous rocks that had solidified and cooled. In some places, they noticed compressional features, where places where rocks had been scrunched and crushed, caused to form into these folds, where the rock itself has been folded up like a piece of paper that you kind of push from either end. And you can get rocks that will look like that. In other places, it's obvious that they've been pulled apart. You get tensional features, cracks and faults, grabens, valleys that form with, you pull it apart and the center falls in, kind of thing. And these early geologists recognized that. And also, right from the very beginning, people noticed when maps were being made of the world, as you all no doubt have done, noticed that South America and Africa fit together. If you cut one out and you can move it next to it, it's a nearly perfect fit. And it's actually a much better fit if you take not the present shorelines, but the edge of the continental shelf, which is really where the continents truly end. And you cut it out along there, and there's probably less than 1 or 2% overlap or gap between those two. And the same, it's a bit more complicated in other parts of the world, but there are, North America and Europe fit together in the same way. And these early geologists noticed that. And so these were things that their conceptual framework for the Earth had to include all this stuff. So early on, they realized that the Earth had been hot from these molten rocks that had cooled. So they thought, well, if it started out hot, and it's not all that hot on the surface today, although notwithstanding a few volcanoes, maybe the Earth is cooling and shrinking. And that would explain how we get the crusts kind of buckling up in places and forming some mountain ranges. Well, that didn't really explain how you get the tensional features, nor did it explain how you could get continents that were pulled apart. Then at the turn of the century, Madame Curie discovered radioactivity, and geologists soon realized that the material in the core of the Earth was still producing heat, something that wasn't realized before, so that, well, if it's still producing heat, maybe the Earth's getting hotter and is actually expanding. And in that case, that would explain continents pulling apart. It would explain the tensional features, but they had to stretch their ideas a bit to explain how you get compressional mountain ranges. And then there was a German meteorologist, Alfred Wegener, in 1912, came up with this crazy idea of continental drift. And he was taking these patterns of the continents and fitting them together and said, well, there has to be some way these continents have moved around in the past. And he was basing his arguments mostly just on the geometry of the continents. And all the respectable scientists of the day nodded their heads and said, yeah, that looks interesting, but they had no conceptual framework to make it happen. They said, continents can't plow through solid crust and move around. I mean, there's no way that can happen. So nobody took the idea seriously. So it stayed that way up through just 30, 40 years ago, mid-20th century. We had all this information and not really any good way to put it all together. And then discovery of paleomagnetism came in, which was a first key step. And that is the whole idea that rocks, when they form, can freeze, or take a snapshot of the Earth's magnetic field. And it may not seem like a very important concept just on the surface, but you know, we have the Earth, and its magnetic field goes from the poles, which are not exactly the same as our rotational poles, but something like this. These are the force fields of magnetism. I'll just do half the Earth here, but basically they go way out into space, and if you're on the equator, let's put the equator here, and you hold a compass, the compass points toward the north magnetic pole, and if your compass is perfectly horizontal, the needle will also be horizontal because the force field is parallel with the surface of the Earth at that point and only at that point. If you move north or south, you start to get a dip in your compass needle, and if you hold your compass flat, it'll want to dive into the ground because it's following the force field. Well, geologists recognize that both igneous rocks, the ones that cool from molten magmas, and also sedimentary rocks that have iron in them. This is a key. It has to have a mineral with iron. If these rocks form in a way that they're free to settle out, the particles are free to settle out and be influenced by the magnetic field, they will do so. They will settle down and they will record the Earth's magnetic field at the time that the rock was formed. So geologists in the 50s and early 60s were going around with these magnetometers, devices which could figure out what this old orientation was, and they were able to see that at different times in the history of the Earth, the magnetic pole appeared to wander all over the place. They, you know, one period it would be here, and another time it would be here, and then here, and here, and so they had these lines of what they called apparent pole wandering. And they weren't sure what that meant. They thought that the actual magnetic pole did move. Another key realization came when, as they were studying the magnetism in these old rocks, was that the North Pole wasn't always the North Pole. At some times in the Earth's history, the Earth's magnetic field does a flip-flop, and the South Pole becomes the North Pole and vice versa. And the whole field reverses. We don't even know exactly what effect that has on climate and on life on Earth, but it's done it many, many times through the Earth's history. And we don't know when it's going to happen again, too, so that could cause a few problems. So anyway, going back through time, we have this history of normal polarity, reverse polarity, normal polarity, reverse polarity. Well, back in 1962, a professor from Princeton theorized that after some studies of the ocean basins, they realized that there were these features in the ocean basins called mid-ocean ridges. They didn't know what they were there for, but they recognized them from their bathymetry studies. And this professor, Harry Hess, postulated that perhaps these ridges were places where new crust was being created. And he was basing his argument just on the geometrical arguments of what they found down there. Some students of his, I don't know if they were his, but at the time they were graduate students, and decided to put this hypothesis to the test. They were oceanographers, and on a cruise they started towing a magnetometer across some of these mid-ocean ridges. There was also a Canadian by the name of Morley who was doing the same thing and independently arrived at the same conclusions. If this is the ridge going down the, say, the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, what they found as they tracked across was that there were parallel bands of magnetism that were mirror images of each other on either side of the ridge. So there'd be a thick zone of normal on either side, and then there'd be reversed, and then there'd be a thin normal over here, and a thin normal over here, and then another thicker one, and another thicker one, and so on. And as they towed this thing across, they found this to be the case everywhere, all over the surface of the Earth. And thus, this concept of seafloor spreading finally had some physical evidence that people could believe, that, you know, hard, concrete evidence, the kind that science like. So, the hypothesis of plate tectonics, as it's now called, was born. And this is the new paradigm, the new vision for how the Earth works. And since the early and mid-60s, when this work was done, everything that geologists have been doing since then amazingly fits very, very well with this theory. So the theory is on very solid ground right now. So let me go into kind of what the whole theory entails. Let me start by just having you imagine an egg that is not egg-shaped but round. And it's got a shell, and it's got kind of a viscous yolk inside, or a viscous white, and then the yolk inside that. The Earth is a lot like that. The Earth has a rigid shell, which is about in the same proportion to its overall diameter as the eggshell is to the diameter of an egg. Okay, underneath the crust is more plastic material, and let's kind of do this. We'll call this the crust itself. In where continents are, the crust is quite thick, 20, 30, 40 kilometers thick. In the ocean basins, it's quite thin, usually less than 10 kilometers thick. And then we call this the crust, and what is below that has been long called by geologists the mantle. Geologists thought it was fairly solid, and that you didn't really get to the more liquid stuff until you got quite deep down, more toward the core. Well, there's a boundary about 100 kilometers down, and so this is about 100 kilometers, and includes the crust and part of the upper mantle, and this is called the lithosphere. And this is essentially what makes the plates. It's the relatively rigid material that makes up the eggshell that moves over the surface. And below that is a zone which is very plastic and ductile, and it's called the asthenosphere. Okay, these plates then, there are six made, the Earth's crust is made up of six major plates and then a whole bunch of little ones. So imagine this egg having fractures in the eggshell, and imagine each one being able to move relative to any of the others. And that's what happens on the surface of the Earth. All of these plates are in constant motion. They move at rates varying from 1 or 2 up to 15 centimeters per year. So they are moving fairly rapidly, given the scale of things. And there are basically three ways in which the crust margins, the crustal margins, can interact. They can pull apart, which is what happens at the mid-ocean ridges, what we call spreading centers. And literally, there is a tension there. It pulls the crust apart, and new magma, which is the molten rock, comes up and fills the crack in this that is formed from the pull apart. That new magma solidifies, and new crust is created. And it just keeps going. It's a conveyor belt kind of a situation. And so these guys are pulling apart, and a few centimeters a year, So there's constant, you know, refurbishing or renewal of material in that crack zone. It happens out in the middle of ocean basins, largely, and that's because things are pulled apart, ocean crust is thin, the water flows in and covers it over. But there are places where these things have happened or are in the beginning stages of happening on land. We have a rift in the United States that we're not sure if it's going to develop much further. Yeah?
Yes, on the, a little side corollary question. On the subject of magma, has it been established whether magma is something that exists as a result of, let's say, radioactive activity in the core of the Earth, or the result of pressure of layers of rocks on top of each other to the point that the compression creates liquidity, if you will?
It's a combination of both. Okay. They're both important factors. And the pressure mechanism is important in the mountains, in the formation of the mountains, and we'll talk about that in a bit. Let's see, where was I?
Where do we have a rift in the United States?
All right. A place called in the Rio Grande Valley. It's called the Rio Grande Rift. And it is a place where the crust is very thin and where some spreading or some pulling apart has occurred. And we don't know if that will evolve further or not, because a lot of these will start to pull apart and then stop. In Africa, the East African Rift Zone is another one of these. In Kenya, the Red Sea is a new beginning ocean basin. There's a rift down the middle of the Red Sea, and that's pulling apart. And now the water has come in and covered that. And new oceanic crust has filled the gap between the two pieces of continental crust on either side. And so basically anywhere you go in the world, you're going to find these kinds of things. Okay, so we can pull it apart. We can also slide it past each other. Some places, you know, one plate's going to be going in one direction, the other plate's going to be going the other direction. We call these transformed faults. And these are also widespread, and the most famous one is the San Andreas Fault, California. And its associated faults which are with it. Los Angeles and the western side is attached to the Pacific Plate. Everything on the east is part of the North American Plate. In so many million years, Los Angeles is going to be right next to San Francisco because that's the direction it's moving right now. And as you also know, there's a lot of pressure, a lot of friction involved in two plates sliding past each other. And so these zones are zones of earthquake generation, and important zones of that. And then finally, there are places where crust has to come together if our system is free to move basically in an unconstrained way. And these things happen in what we call convergence zones or subduction zones. And basically what happens is that the denser plate, if we have two contrasting types and the oceanic crust is denser than the continental crust, it will be subducted or pushed underneath the continental crust. If we have two bits of oceanic plate, it's a fight for which one's going to subduct under the other one. Yeah.
If they're both made the same stuff, how does one of them get to be denser?
Well, they're not made of the same stuff. Oceanic crust is made primarily of basalt. That's a rock type which is rich in minerals composed of iron and magnesium. They have higher mineral densities. They are maybe 10% denser, not much, 10% denser than the typical continental rocks. Continental rocks are made of more what we call granitic type rocks. They have minerals that are richer in elements like potassium, calcium, sodium, large, lightweight elements, and the minerals that they make up are much less dense. So the continental crust is lighter weight, although it's thicker, I shouldn't say it's lighter weight, it's less dense. And so it tends to ride high on the underlying. We have mountain processes building up these mountains and forming compression zones and building up thicknesses of continental crust. We also have what we call an isostatic effect. It's a buoyancy effect, which tends to cause these mountain zones to uplift, in addition to just the pressure from the side. Yeah?
You're accustomed to thinking in metrics. You gave us the metric depth of the land mass and the ocean on the eggshell. How could you give us a sense in miles?
Take 6 tenths of it.
Yeah.
100 kilometers would be about 60 miles.
60 yep. miles thick.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, I sometimes try to go back and forth between the two units. I get horribly confused, so I just stick with it.
The older generation.
Yeah, 0.6 is the conversion. Yep.
There are more and more faults being discovered, aren't there?
There are lots of different kinds of faults, yes. And we are discovering new ones in lots of new places.
And some are quite short and some are quite long.
Yep. The process of building mountains creates lots of stress in the rocks, and a lot of this stress is taken up in faulting. And some of that will be very localized, but some faults tend to be quite deeply rooted, and the transform faults are faults that go completely through the crust.
3-4 weeks ago, there was an article in the Seattle Times where they identified a fault now that runs from the Olympic Peninsula right through Renton and a little further east. It was rather interesting to find that they're defining that well, because I'd never recognized or heard that about that particular fault.
Well, a lot of the faults that they're discovering now are hidden from the surface because there are younger deposits sitting on top of them that show no evidence of breakage of the crust. And they're being discovered by a more sophisticated means of, geophysical means, magnetics, gravity measurements, where they make very careful measurements of the force of gravity, and they'll find that when they cross these faults, they're moving from one rock type to another, and suddenly there's more pull than there was on the other side, and defining linear zones like that, and they assume they're faults. Yeah.
What is the mechanism or mechanisms causing plate movement?
Well, let me kind of get into that. Okay. Yeah, let me draw a picture of kind of how we visualize the whole thing happening. You know, we really don't know is the short answer. There are some theories.
You're gonna dazzle us with some footwork.
Okay, let's build the. A mid-ocean ridge out here, and they're raised slightly higher than the surrounding ocean basins because being hotter, and they'll stay hot for quite a while, they are less dense simply due to the heat, even though the composition is the same. So they're kind of raised up a little from that thermal expansion. Okay, so we've got very thin crust here, and in fact we have magma, molten rock, coming in and filling these gaps, which is forming the crust. This is the spreading center. Okay, then this basaltic crust will continue for some distance, depending on the age of this spreading center. If it's a young one, we'll probably have continental crust not too far away. If it's an old one, and it's had a time to really spread for some time, we get quite a bit of distance between the chunks of continental crust. And the oldest continental or the oldest ocean crust that we can find anywhere is on the edges of the Atlantic Ocean, and that's about goes back to mid-Jurassic time. So the ocean basins are relatively young compared to the age of the Earth. crust is constantly being renewed. Once we get toward the edge of a subduction, or when we get to a subduction zone, the crust dives down. And these zones were recognized long before the theory of plate tectonics occurred. They were called Benioff zones, named after a Russian seismologist who recognized that earthquakes under mountain ranges tended to get deeper and deeper the further you got away from the coastline. And what he was seeing was the stresses exerted on this slab of crust as it's being pushed down into this plastic asthenosphere below. Okay, then we've got the continental crust here, and I'll use this example will be what we have here basically in the Northwest with the Cascades. We have, I'll start it here. And we have a much thickened zone of this continental crust. And it stays thicker out here in the mid-North American zone, although it is not so deformed. The rocks in mid-North America are very flat-lying, little deformed. They've been depositing sediments there for millions of years. And this is a zone we generally call a craton. It's the more stable core of the continent. But here in the Cascades, we have a lot of folding and crunching and metamorphism being a process by which heat and pressure change minerals to new mineral types. And also, there is sediment that sits on these, that rain down in the oceans and sits on the ocean floor. And what happens when we get toward one of these subduction zones is that this stuff kind of gets piled up and crunched and jammed into this gap. And it becomes a unique type of rock. It's a metamorphosed rock because it's very high pressure there in this crunch zone, but it's not very deeply buried, so it doesn't heat up due to the pressure from the burial and the radioactive heat. So they have a very unique mineral assemblage, and we call these blue schists. And these, in the North Cascades, these rocks can be found on the west side of the North Cascades Highway before you get into the granites and the more heavily metamorphosed rocks. Then the core of the mountain range is the zone of regional metamorphism, and that's just heat and pressure, and as you say, there's burial because this is such a thick accumulation of material, there's a lot of weight, and these rocks will change from being sediments, they might have been basalts or granites or anything to start with, but this heat and pressure will change them into a suite of minerals and rocks that is unique for the pressure and temperature range that they're found in.
Could you impose on there a water level as to the surface of the ocean in relation to your diagram that you already have?
Okay, this is really not perfectly to scale.
Yeah,
but
at least we'll give an
idea. Yeah, maybe we could do something like this.
Okay.
But these can come up onto the surface too, up onto, become dry land. If any of you are familiar with Northern California, there's a suite of rocks down there called the Franciscan terrain. It's basically from San Francisco north, and the rocks are just all sheared and, all beat to heck. They're really yucky rocks. And they are some of this what we call a melange mixture. It's French for mixture. And these types of rocks are represented there. We also see them in the Olympics of Washington, melange-type rocks. But then we move into the core. What we have is, and we are sitting here in the core of the North Cascades, we have regional metamorphic rocks, or regionally metamorphosed rocks under us, right, as we sit here. And these have been metamorphosed by the heat and pressure of this compression that occurs. The heat and pressure can be so high, in fact, that in the lower zones of the continental crust, the crustal rocks will actually melt completely and form new magmas that are a different composition than what we might otherwise get. And these tend to be the real so-called lightweight granitic rocks, the true granites and the granodiorites. And what we have around here is a rock called granodiorite. Tomorrow, we'll kind of get into what these rocks are made of a little bit more. And so we get a blob of hot, molten granite, basically, a magma. And it then, because of the heat and because of some crystallization that occurs and where the heavier minerals will drop out, leaving an even less dense melt behind, this blob of granite will want to buoyantly move up, and they do. They push their way right up through the crust. And so we have these blobs of granite in lots of different zones, and some of them actually have come out to the surface. Okay, getting back to the sediment though, some of this sediment gets past this crunch point here and gets carried down into the lower parts on this downriding slab, being pushed down into some very hot areas. And because it contains so much water, being ocean sediments, and the presence of water does amazing things to the chemistry of minerals. If you heat a so-called dry mineral, you have to go to very high temperatures to make that mineral molten again. But if you heat it in the presence of water, it will melt at a much lower temperature, several hundred degrees lower temperature. So water is a real important catalyst for melt reactions in minerals. And this wet sediment then gets melted down here and remobilized. And so we get blobs of this stuff kind of starting to rise too. Again, because of its heat and mineral composition, it is less dense, more buoyant than the stuff it finds itself in. So it's coming up like a, you know, like a beach ball at the bottom of a swimming pool. It wants to come up, and there's not much that's going to hold it down. And it will shoulder its way up through the continental crust as well. And usually these things follow a zone of preferred weakness where blobs of this stuff have gone many times before. And these break out on the surface as volcanoes. And now these granitic rocks can also have volcanic manifestations on the surface, but we're talking different chemistries here. These rocks are a rock called andesite, and these are typical of subduction zone volcanoes. This process will go on for millions of years, and it has in the Cascades. We know from the rocks in the Cascades that there have been volcanoes produced here at least back in the last 30 million years. And let's see, what else do I want to say about that? Let me just give you a little bit more of the terminology of these rocks. The one that is richest in the lightweight elements would be granite. Well, no, let me. I'm doing this, mixing them up here. The andesite is a volcanic rock, so I need to stay in the volcanic terminology. The lightweight volcanic one is called rhyolite. And its equivalent is granite. Now, a volcanic rock is a rock that erupts at the surface and cools quickly. And when a rock cools very quickly, its crystals are very small. If the rock remains deeper in the crust and cools very slowly over thousands and millions of years, it has a chance to arrange its atoms in a much more orderly way, and the minerals will form much larger crystals. So a rock can have exactly the same chemistry, the same minerals, but look very different, and we give it two different names. So if it pops out on the surface and cools quickly, it's rhyolite here. If it's stays in the crust and cools slowly with larger crystals, it's a granite. Now, as I said, these are the rocks that are low density. They're rich in sodium, calcium, potassium. Relatively little of the heavy minerals that contain iron and magnesium. But, and they also are very rich in silica. And I'll talk about this tomorrow. As we move down a compositional gradient here, we come to a rock called dacite. Dacite is the volcanic rock that blew out of Mount St. Helens, and it's the most common volcanic rock in the Cascades. Its equivalent is a rock called granodiorite, and it looks very much like granite. The main difference being that it has less quartz and does not contain potassium feldspars. And again, that's something we'll talk about more tomorrow. we go down to andesite next. There are only four of these, so it's not going to get too complicated. Andesite is a bit more rich in the iron and magnesium minerals. It's the basic stuff that forms the magmas here. And dacites form from andesite magmas just by dropping out some of the heavy, dense minerals on the way up through the crust. Its coarse grain equivalent is diorite. And then finally, at the, I'll call this silica plus plus for silica rich. And down here, we're much reduced in our silica content. At the low end of the scale is basalt. And basalt is kind of what your basic generic magma that the Earth produces. That's the stuff that comes up out of the mantle and forms in the spreading ridges and the mid-ocean ridges. That's the starting stuff from which all of these others kind of evolve. And its coarse grain equivalent is gabbro.
Now what part of that is ash? When it finally blows.
Okay, ash is just tiny fragments of any of these.
Oh, it is.
It's called ash because it's usually kind of gray color and it kind of looks like ash. But it's just the result of an explosion at a volcano that has blown the rocks to smithereens, basically. Mm-hmm. And they tend to occur mostly up here at this end of things because when you have a rock rich in silica, it becomes very viscous. Mm-hmm. The silica is really important in the viscosity of the magma itself. Basalt, lavas, we call a lava magma once it gets onto the surface. It's a magma when it's underground, it's a lava when it's on the surface. Basalt lavas can flow almost like water, although they're considerably more viscous than water, but they can flow very fast on the surface. And in Hawaii, we see movies of these lava flows really clipping along. By the time you get up to dacite, the stuff gets so viscous that it can hardly flow at all. And in fact, can't flow as a true lava flow. It can only form big mushroom-shaped blobs. The stuff tries to come out of the vent and it sort of oozes down like a big hat over the vent. And eventually the pressure builds up and it blows itself up and a new one forms. These are called lava domes. Mm-hmm. And rhyolite is even more sticky and viscous, and it can't flow at all. It just explodes all the time. And another term you might have heard is obsidian for volcanic glass. Again, that can be any of these, although they tend more to be up in this end of the range at the lightweight end. And that's just rock that has cooled very, very quickly and hasn't had a chance to form any crystals at all. And its atoms are totally disorganized. It's frozen magma without any chance to kind of organize itself in separate mineral grains. Yeah.
In the Mount St. Helens blow then, we had ash that traveled as far as over into Montana, other ash that settled closely. Now, is that the result of the same material at different size particles, or was it a combination of that with different materials that would have heavier, more dense material that would settle closer range?
It's,
or a mixture of the whole works?
It's mostly a combination of total volume and the force of the eruption, which in turn is crucial in getting that stuff up high. If you get it up high and you get a lot up there, the wind's going to take it, and it will travel a long distance. Small eruptions don't get quite high enough. You have to kind of get up in the stratosphere with the ash to really get your long distance travel.
Jet streams, so
yeah,
to speak.
Yeah. Now, Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines in 1991 was a much bigger eruption than Mount St. Helens. And it got stuff way up there, a lot of it, and it had more of an effect on climate. As you may know, world climate was depressed, or world temperature, average temperature, was depressed about a degree over the last year or two due to that Mount Pinatubo eruption. And the ash up in there absorbs sunlight, doesn't let the radiant heat get down to the earth and cools things.
Well, is it mostly of the rhyolite material or basaltic material?
Ash?
Yes.
Well, it depends on the volcano, although it would big ash eruptions are either rhyolite or dacite.
Okay.
Because these others just aren't explosive enough. The stuff is runnier and will ooze out and form lava flows rather than explode.
Okay.
Andesite and basalt, you get a little bit of localized ash formed, but nothing on the scale of these. And your really super catastrophic eruptions are going to be rhyolite eruptions. We have not had any of those in quite some time on the Earth. The last one that I can think of right now was in 1912 in Alaska, at a place called Katmai, or Valley of 10,000 Smokes. That was quite a large eruption. Yellowstone is a giant volcano, and it erupted some 700,000 years ago, poured ash all over the mid-United States, enough to, it would have wiped out all life in the central United States at that time.
Hmm.
And couldn't do it again. Yellowstone is still a potentially active volcanic center. Yeah.
So the Hawaiian lava is close to the bottom of the cliffs there, as far as basalt and rhyolite goes. Or the volcanoes.
Yeah, they are basaltic volcanoes. And those, the Hawaiian volcanoes are kind of interesting. They form under what are known as hot spots. And these are zones, people don't know why they form. I should get back to your question too about mechanism here. There are zones deep in the mantle in the asthenosphere that seem to be hot and seem to be stable. And they are producing heat, and as this crust moves over it, periodically it manages to punch through and cause volcanoes to form. But you form a chain of progressively younger and younger volcanoes, depending on which way you're going, at those sites. And the Hawaiian Islands is a chain over a hot spot. The Big Island of Hawaii is the youngest one. It's on the surface. There's one still to the southeast that's even younger that hasn't yet broken the surface. It's a new one called Lo'ihi. It's about 1,000 feet below the water surface, but it, you know, in a few thousand years, it's going to pop up and it'll be the next Hawaiian volcano or Hawaiian island. You get out at the other end, Kauai, those rocks are 4 or 5 million years old. And these hot spots also let geologists figure out what the absolute motion of these plates is. Lets us know how they've moved relative to a fixed point. Now, in terms of the mechanism, the best hypothesis going is convection. That you get, the Earth has a very hot core, a lot of radioactivity down in the core. When you put a pot of water on the surface of a stove and turn on the heat, you start to get convective cells forming in zones where hot water is coming up, flows along the surface, and then cools slightly, and then sinks back down, and you get these cells evolving. They think what is happening is that the convective cells are kind of doing this. And that the plates are then responding to this convection in the more fluid underlying part of the Earth. And they're just kind of being dragged along on the surface. There would also be some gravity effects going. You have this stuff raised up slightly. not a lot in terms of topography, but enough to add a gravitational component that's pushing the plate away. And again, here, this stuff's going down, it's going to be dragging the crust along with it too. So it's probably a combination of some of these different mechanisms. So basically that, in a nutshell, is where we are. Tomorrow, if you're able to join us, we will go out. Well, I'll bring some rocks in here for the next room over. We'll look at them. I'll say a little bit about them, what they're made of, and then we'll go out on the trail and take a look at them.